do a few concluding comments. We're going to spend a little bit of time. I said I would touch on instrumental music. For those of you that maybe haven't been with us, we're going through various aspects of our public worship service. We've discussed the attitude of it. We spent really two sessions on the communion, the Lord's Supper, and various elements of that. Last night we spent a little bit of time on mutual edification. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time, not necessarily our whole time, but I'm willing to if you would like to. Because I know we've discussed this, I've discussed it with you, and I suspect others and within your own congregations you have discussed it. But we are one of the few religious organizations in the United States and probably in the world that does not use instruments as part of our worship service. I said last night, when visitors come to us or come to our worship service, they probably immediately think of where are the two P's, the preacher and the piano. And certainly there are other musical instruments other than the piano. But I want to spend a little bit of time on it because we can assume that we're all on the same page, and we can assume that the younger ones in our classes osmotically absorb what we already have settled in our minds. But I found that that doesn't happen. We all need to be taught. We all need to rethink it. So I'm going to go through a few points, and then I'm going to pause and allow you to make any comments or questions. You may have some additional thoughts or some additional comments that would be beneficial, not simply to convince us, but also to give us bullets, if you will, to discuss it with other people who might see it different. From a historical perspective, instruments in the American worship scene were really not prevalent until approximately the Civil War. In the first half of that 1800s, the churches that we commonly now call Churches of Christ, Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, and Baptist Church were all the same organization. And not totally, but essentially, the split around the Civil War time that severed that unified group into at least four or five different segments that we now recognize in our denominational world was over instrumental music and the preacher system. There were some peripheral areas like Bible colleges that entered into it, but those were the dominant reasons. Most of the restorers and reformers were against it, but their descendants, or their followers, not really their biological descendants, began to use it. And there's been a long history of once a group starts using instrumental music, very, 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 very seldom do they ever give it up. And I think there are simply some physiological and emotional reasons for that. But I'd like to for us to remember a passage in Corinthians where Paul, in a very brief verse, says, "We walk by faith and not by sight." And you might say, well, what does sight have to do with instrumental music? I think what Paul was really saying is, we are walking by a spiritual faith rather than a sensual stimulation. And I don't mean by sensual stimulation anything sexual. I just mean a stimulation of our senses. And really, the old law, and even the patriarchal law, was in some essence a sensual religion. And by that I mean they had animal sacrifices. If you were to go to the tabernacle or temple grounds, there would be this constant noise, this constant aroma. The priests were adorned in very elaborate garb, as instructed by God for the Mosaical dispensation. And there is some reference to music. We can debate exactly what that reference was in the Old Testament, but there are some clear references to it. And it seems to me like the old law was in many respects a more sensual or sense-oriented religion than what Jesus and the apostles brought to us. And therefore Paul says, now we walk by faith and not by sight. And I think you can also place that with the passage in Acts chapter 17 where it says, now at the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. There was a different standard under the New Testament covenant. Jesus alluded to that in the Sermon on the Mount. You have heard it said, but I say unto you. It was all the initiation of a more mental, spiritual religion rather than a physical, sensual religion. And I think to a large extent, instrumental music over the ages has been not a sexual, but a sense, S-E-N-S-E, sense-oriented appealment. And I can understand that. I enjoy good music. I think most people here, whether we can produce good music or not, we enjoy it. And sometimes instruments make it more enjoyable to our senses. Now, having said that, I want to go through five things that I think are important for us to keep in mind. Some of these are our points, and some of these are counter-arguments to arguments that have been brought up. Number one, it is often said that instruments are mentioned and used in the Old Testament, and that is a true statement. David, very much of a musician, and he played most of his psalms probably with some form of an instrument. There were times when God told them to get the tambourine or the cymbal. Now, there's debate as to whether that was actually used in the Old Testament worship with their songs. It may have been more as a way to call the meeting to order. You got to remember, they didn't have clocks back then. Now, they had a sense of time, but they couldn't look at their wrist and say, okay, it's 9:30, we need to be in the assembly, or 10, whenever you assemble. So there had to be a calling to order, and it may have been that more than actually what we would call an accompaniment. But they are mentioned in the Old Testament. And so that is sometimes used as a, well, obviously, if God allowed it then, why would it be wrong now? Well, I think that argument can be pretty well met if we just think through that there were a lot of things that were part of the Old Testament worship that we don't do today. If I'm going to take the position that if they did it in the Old Testament, we ought to do it today, then we need to have animal sacrifices. We need to have gold furniture in our assembly. We need to have a separate priesthood, which gets back to the separation of laity and clergy. We need to have a temple, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me that that argument really isn't accurate, but even if you take the position that they did use it in their worship, that doesn't have really too much to say about what the Lord wants us to do in the church, because he did away with all those other things, so why would he not do away with that? The old law is simply not a model or a pattern for our worship today. Now, there are types and shadows, and we've talked about those, but that is different than it being a pattern for our worship today. The model and the pattern for our worship service today is the New Testament, and the examples and the commandments and the inferences that we get from the New Testament and instruction given by the Holy Spirit through inspired writers. And nowhere in the New Testament do I find where we are instructed to use instruments. And I found very, very few people who take that position that we are commanded to use instruments. It is more often a commandment, well, we're not told we can't, therefore we can. Well, that's an interesting argument. There are a lot of things that we aren't told we can't by commandment, but we are told that we shouldn't by inference. For instance, we spent two nights on the communion. Nowhere does it say not to use coffee in the cup for communion. There's just no verse in there that says don't use tea or orange juice. But we are told what to do. And by telling us what to do, we have a clear inference that other things are excluded. And that's very obvious to us in that almost ludicrous illustration I just gave you. But it's sometimes not as obvious when we get to instrumental music. Point number two, and I may pause before I go through all five of these because that's a lot to ask you to remember. If the early church did not use instruments in their worship, and there's no indication in scriptures that they did, and if God had wanted instruments used in his worship, why doesn't the New Testament contain an admonition from one of the holy writers correcting the situation? In other words, if the early church did not, and we have no inference that they did, use instruments in their worship, and God had wanted them, I have never found God or Paul or any of the inspired writers to be shy about correcting an error. And in fact, most of the books that we have and epistles that we have in the New Testament are filled with gentle, loving corrections of error. If God had wanted it and they weren't using it, I have no question in my mind that God would have, through the writers, made that point. I simply can't find anywhere where Paul says, you need to start using these in order to be acceptable. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 19, a very famous verse, it says, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart. That is a very internal singing. We'll talk a little bit about that word psalms in a minute. Colossians chapter 3, verse 16. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing, not playing, singing with grace into your hearts. I think what we've got is it's a heart issue, and all worship is a heart issue. And God is looking at what we do to glorify Him with our hearts. And I think our singing is also correct in that. Point number three, taking the Bible out of the picture for just a moment, if you'll allow me, historians historically unanimously say that instruments were not used in the apostolic era. Remember the sheet that I handed out to you last night? It was not until the 600 ADs that the papal system even acknowledged the possibility of using instruments in the worship. And it wasn't for another 500 years after that they began doing it. In other words, it was 1,100 years after the church was established before churches to any degree even used instruments. And then it was largely rejected, and it was certainly rejected by the reformers and the restorers in their early days. John Calvin, and we've talked about Calvinism on various occasions at Dean Avenue, and I've probably touched on it here. He's one of the people that people that believe once saved, always saved, and so forth, adhere to his doctrine, said about instrumental music, it is no more suitable than burning incense. And really, he was getting back to the first point I made. If you're going to say that instruments in the Old Testament mean we should use them now, well, they burned incense in the Old Testament, we ought to burn it now. And I don't think the Protestant religions consider that. Martin Luther, obviously, a forerunner, I wouldn't want to call him a founder, but he was a forerunner of the Lutheran Church, called instrumental music the ensign of Baal, or the sign of the devil. John Wesley, whose followers became what we know as the Methodist Church, says in that classic line, I have no objection to an organ in our chapels, provided it is neither seen nor heard. And I know you've heard that so many times, it's almost embarrassing to say it again, but it is appropriate. Adam Clark, and some of us still use Adam Clark's commentaries, and he does some very good work, talked about instrumental music, and he says, I abominate it, and it is an abhorrence to me. Now, it's interesting that it was only after these men were dead that their followers, as they went into various sects and denominations, began to bring it in. Now, those men weren't inspired. They weren't inspired in any way. But it does show at least their understanding and the understandings of some of the founders of religions today who are very much into this, adamantly being opposed to it. I point that out because sometimes we think, well, we're just being difficult. We're just being odd, and nobody thinks like us. And why in the world do we do it this way? Well, remember, we've had a lot of company. It's not our belief in a cappella singing that has really changed. It's the belief of others in non-a cappella singing that has changed. I'm going to pause before I go into my fourth and fifth points, and I don't know that anything I said will gender it up, but I want to give you a chance to make a comment or ask a question before I get too far down here and you forget anything you might have. I've got David up here, Marty.
We're told that the Lord reminds us that His ways are not our ways and our thoughts are not His thoughts. And when we look back in the Old Testament, the Lord talked about building altars to Him. the instructions were to use natural stones and not to use hewn stones because they would be polluted because man's hand had touched them. And I was wondering, in Acts chapter 17, verses 24 and 25, God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelt not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. And I was wondering your thoughts about the fact that if whether this verse could be looked upon in the way that God thinks different than we do, and he didn't want man's hands polluting the stones in the Old Testament, is it possible we also cannot be, any instrument that we made would be man-made? Is it possible that would fall into that category of cannot worship God with man's hands by instruments that were made by man?
Okay, I think that's an interesting point, and if I understand it, I think there is a valid point there. I think the passages you read in Acts 17 are probably a further indication of what I was trying to say earlier, the difference in the more physically oriented Old Testament worship and the more spiritually oriented New Testament worship. Because in the Old Testament, they did worship God in temples made with hands. The temple was constructed by men. Now, it was under God's guidance. But I think the tenor there is to say, now he's going to want us to have a more spiritual worship. And that doesn't mean the Old Testament wasn't spiritual, but it was more sensual. And certainly a worship, an instrument, nothing physical, nothing other than man can worship God. So obviously an instrument couldn't. This building can't worship God. Nothing can worship God except man. Animals can't worship God. They just don't have the capacity to do it. Only man can worship God. Good point. Marvin.
There are those who believe, who use instrumental music that say, well, it helps us with our singing. But in assemblies where I've been where they used it, the singing was miserable sometimes. Of course, it's miserable sometimes in our assemblies too, but I think that's a feeble excuse.
Okay, well, I would agree with you, but whenever we start thinking our singing or anything doesn't sound good, we're overlaying what we think sounds good for what ought to be what God thinks sounds good. If we brought in, where do you go, Brad? Iowa State? If we brought in Brad's group from Iowa State and had them sing for us, it would sound better than we do. I'm very comfortable in making that. It would sound better to us, but it wouldn't necessarily sound better to God, because God's listening to the heart and not the vocal cords. Now, we need to sing the best we can, but if you can't carry a tune in a bucket, you just sing as loud as you can, because God loves it. And that tells me, when someone who really can't sing does sing, that they're more interested in pleasing God than sounding pretty to the people sitting around them. Now, you might be considered, if you're really bad, you know, don't sing real, real loud. But I know people that won't sing because they don't think they have a pretty voice. And I'm sorry, and there may be some here that fall into that category. I don't know of any of you that do, but I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong. That's like saying, God didn't give me enough talent to praise him. And I don't believe that. It might not sound good to me or you, but that's somewhat irrelevant. It's quite irrelevant. It's a heart thing. Thank you. Where are we at? Who's got the mic? Suzanne, then we'll come up to Marge. Her hand's up, Marty. Suzanne.
Maybe someone can shed some light on this, but I have been told that a lot of Jewish weddings, even today, are not held in their synagogues because there is no instrumental music in the synagogue. Is that correct? Does anyone know that?
I can comment on that, and then Julene will correct me. I don't know that there is no instrumental music in synagogues, but I do know that in the early days of the synagogues, they did not use instrumental music, even though it was used in the temple courtyard. And that was one of the changes from the temple worship to the synagogue worship. I don't know about Jewish weddings, so I can't bespeak that. But I know some synagogues, and certainly early on, and the synagogues were probably started during the Babylonian captivity, they did not use instrumental music for whatever reason. But I don't know that I could say that Jews in their worship are anti-instrumental music. I wouldn't want to go that far. Seriously, do you know something about that, Julene?
Yeah, we recently went to a bar mitzvah, and they used instrumental music.
Okay, I suspect that synagogues are like churches of Christ. They come in different varieties. Some are very strict and some are not. But I know that there have been times when leaders of the synagogue did not allow it in. But that's about as much as I can bespeak it. I am told that there are a few exceptions to this, but probably the second largest, no, they're probably larger than we are. The second group that most commonly does not use instruments is the Greek Orthodox Church. Now, some of the American Greek Orthodox churches do, but some of the more conservative ones in Turkey or Constantinople do not, which makes it interesting because they, of all people, should understand what the Greek New Testament really said. So I've always thought that was interesting. Marge, do you have the mic? Okay.
My personal belief is that I really appreciate a cappella singing. However, sometimes when we're learning music or as families get together and sing or as we get together as church groups and want to help each other, I don't have an objection to using a piano or another instrument. Some people object to that. Could I just hear some input from you?
Okay. If I understood what you said, I would tend to agree with you. But I make a distinction between a group of Christians getting together to learn a song and our worship service. If I don't know a song, and even if it's in the worship service and somebody leads a song and I don't know it, I am so focused on trying to get close to something that everyone else is doing that I'm not really focusing on the words. That's why I don't like us to use new songs in some parts of our worship service. Now, that's a personal opinion. I like to use songs that we all can worship the Lord with. But in the privacy of our home or outside of the worship service to learn a song, that to me is quite a different issue. Now, we'll have those here that don't take that position, and that's okay, but that's the way I do view it. I was just kind of smiling because one time I was with a group that didn't want to use a piano, so what we did is we ended up blowing every note in the song on one of these, which really was the same thing, only not near as well. But that brings up another issue. If we're going to use this, why not use a piano? Well, the difference is this is an instrument to get us started. This is not an accompaniment for our worship service. But if anybody in my fellowship, in my congregation was offended by the use of one of these, I just quit using them. Now, because it's not worth offending anybody over. But it's totally different. It is totally different. But anybody want to comment on Marge's? Really, it was a comment more than a question. I tend to do that. I tend to feel that way. Ruth over here, Marty. I don't want to have a big debate on this. It's not worth that, but it's a good comment.
Just what would your take be on, say, if you had a piano or an organ in your home and wanted to sit down and play some of the songs in our book just for your own amazement or amusement, whichever?
Well, in my case, it would be amazement. But yeah. In your case, it would be amusement. I have no problem with that.
Well, I've always kind of wondered
because
about
I make a distinction between private worship and public and our public worship service. I think there are things we do privately as a Christian that are inappropriate for us to do publicly. And that's very easy to see in the area of giving. I think anybody here that wants to give to the American Cancer Society ought to do it. But I would be against the church funds being used for that. Totally different issue. David played his harp, obviously, in the privacy, but that's different than taking it into the temple. Did David.
Just to extend that thought a little bit, would you comment on instrumental music being used at a wedding ceremony?
I have absolutely no problem with instruments being used in a wedding ceremony or a funeral ceremony. I do have a personal conviction that it's unwise to bring those instruments into the church building because of the confusion it brings about. You're going to have non-Christian visitors at funerals and weddings, and they're not going to probably make the distinction. But I've performed many weddings that have instrumental music. I only request that we go to someplace other than the church building, and that's usually not hard to do. I've even performed weddings, and you've gone to weddings, I'm sure, in other denominations. A wedding is a spiritual thing, but it's not a worship service. The building is irrelevant to me. Do you want to follow up with that or disagree, or you just wanted me to say it? Okay. I'm not on the hot seat. But that is sometimes something very... Any of you that do weddings, and that may not be anybody here, well, I'm sure somebody... Go over that with the bride and groom. Don't have that be a big shock at the rehearsal. That's not fair to them. And people just don't understand that. They really... And I can understand why they don't understand it. Marvin?
As I understand it, the Catholic Church considers a wedding a sacrament. Does that make the difference between worship and non-worship? Is everything that's a sacrament an act of worship?
Well, I would say technically things that are a sacrament are a worship, but I'm not sure I would agree with them calling that a sacrament. And I don't want to get into semantics. I might ask you to define sacrament a little more precisely so that I make sure I'm right in my answer. Are you able to do that?
I thought of sacrament. I didn't think that's a sacrament.
He said he's defining sacrament as anything that is sacred, devoted to God. A wedding ceremony is sacred, but it's not a worship service at all to me. Where are we at? Not, I've lost it. Oh, it's back to Marty.
I have it.
Anybody else have something they'd like to say? Well, you may. Let me keep going then. Number four. The Greek word that we find in Philippians 5 and 19 and Colossians 3:16 is psallo, psallo. And it's translated psalm. And it was literally a spiritual song, probably one of the psalms that we have, and they were the early church was Jewish, so the words of those psalms probably rhymed and went to a melody. The argument for instruments is that in some times in history, solo has been defined as to pluck. So they'll say, well, see, he must be talking about instruments because he says to pluck. And you would pluck a harp, or you would pluck a stringed instrument as such. But the problem with taking that too far is that, number one, and there's an excellent book by a man by the name of Caffrey that was done, maybe 100 years ago. And he writes a whole book on the word solo. So I wouldn't call it light reading, but it's available, and if you want to get a copy of it, you can. But his point was that in the first century, you know, words change their meanings. And in the first century, solo did not mean to pluck, it meant to sing. And that seems to be borne out by passages such as 1 Corinthians 14 and 5, which I will turn to. 14 and 15. 1 Corinthians 14 and 15. What is it then? I will pray with the Spirit. I will pray with understanding. I will sing with the Spirit, and I will sing with understanding. That's in the King James. The word that is translated sing there is the word solo. So the translators understood that solo meant to sing. In James chapter 5, verse 13, you have a similar situation where the word sallow is not translated to pluck or even psalms. It's translated to sing. And that seems to bear pretty heavy evidence that in the first century, that was the essence of what they were talking about. So I don't think you can take the word sallow and say, well, in 1000 B.C. it meant to pluck, therefore it necessarily meant it in 100 A.D. The word gentleman is a classic example. When that word was first used, it was a descriptive. It described men who were gentle. Now we say gentleman just to anyone who's a male, and they may not be gentle at all. So words do change their meaning, so we need to keep that in mind. The other point that's sometimes brought up is in the book of Revelations, it does talk about them having harps in heaven. Now, in Revelations chapter 5, verse 8, which is often referred to, we have that wordage, but I think we may have an indication of what it truly means. Revelations chapter 5, verse 8, "And when he had taken the book, the four beasts and 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps, and golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of the saints." So it does say they have harps, but you will notice that when he mentions harps and golden vials, he tells us that they are symbolic for the prayers of the saints. Now, there may be literal harps in heaven. I don't know. If you ask my opinion, I don't think there will be. But I could be wrong, because the Bible just doesn't tell us. But even if there are literal harps or instruments in heaven, that doesn't really tell us that it's okay to use them here in the New Testament church. There are going to be a lot of things in heaven that aren't going to be available to us in the church. I think the reference in Revelation to harps is symbolic. But even if you want to take it literal, it is not a proof text, if you will, or a validation that God wants it in the church. Heaven will contain many things that God did not place in the church, i.e. streets of gold. But that doesn't mean we should have our churches overlaid with gold. I think instrumental music is like most changes that men have made with God's pattern. In many cases, they were sincere attempts to make the worship service more vibrant, more energetic, maybe more on key. But we have to remember that God is looking for worship of a special kind, and human wisdom doesn't equate to God's wisdom. And whether we understand or whether we think it would be better if we tried to tweak God's pattern a little bit, I can't think of a time when man's tried to tweak the worship that God has asked for that it improved it rather than detracted from it. Anybody have a question or a comment you would like to make on instrumental music? I'm not trying to shortchange it, but I think we've gone over this at various times, but I'll discuss it and comment on it to the extent you would like to. Okay. I asked a class of young people, this has probably been a year or two ago, how they thought we could improve our worship service. And one of the things they came up with, and I want to talk about two of the things they came up with. One of them was preparation. And they weren't simply, I don't even think they were primarily talking about the preparation that the song leader or the speaker or the teacher does. Obviously, that needs to be there. I commend this congregation, and I'm not sure just how it got started, although I might have a guess, that on your bulletin, you've got the song numbers all there. Well, that means that to me, the song leader probably had to tell somebody Saturday what his songs were going to be. Well, that doesn't make it automatically better, but it sure lets me think that there's been some preparation and thought given to the song service, as opposed to some of us who are maybe have a tendency just to walk in and, whoops, I'm on for the songs. And we pull out that trusty list that we keep somewhere, and we're off and running. Now that happens to all of us. But these young people were talking about getting their minds prepared, praying before they come to the assembly, listening to gospel music, maybe on the way to the assembly, making sure they were rested so that they could give their best attention to the worship service. They even talked about getting up a little earlier, and that's quite a thing for a high school or college age person to say it. Now, I don't know if they did it, but I was kind of proud of them for bringing it up. They mentioned maybe only watching 5 minutes of the Sunday morning news and using the rest of the time, or maybe we have the radio or the TV on, to meditate. And I kind of talked about that on Sunday. There are passages in the scripture, Ezra in particular, prepared his mind for the worship. I think this is an attitude, it's a heart thing, whether it's the communion or the songs or being prepared. Don't raise your hands, but let's just honestly ask ourselves, how many times do we look over the material for the Sunday morning class if we're not teaching it? You know, okay, we know we're in Acts chapter 5. How many times, how often do we look that over and maybe do a little study so that we can make an edified comment and not just rely on just a few handful of people that are always willing to make a comment? All of that is part of preparation. The other point that they made, I'm going to share this with you. Was in the area of our conduct and our attire, and I expected them when they brought that up that they would mention some things, but they went a little further than I thought they were. They mentioned things like sagging pants, see-through tops, guys wearing pink. I'm not sure I've ever seen that in the worship service, but I guess it could. Church with inappropriate printing and pictures. Barefootedness. I don't know that I've seen that except in the very young, but it could have happened. I'm not all that observant. What they really were talking about as I probed them was dress that distracts other people's attention away from their worship. And I thought that was an extremely valid point. You know, we often say that we need to dress modestly, but we don't define modestly very thoroughly, because we usually define modesty as not being overly revealing. So if your skin's covered, you're modest. Well, that's not true. Immodest dress is any dress that calls attention to that person. So you could overdress, I guess, in theory, maybe a pure white suit, in a sense, could be immodest because it's going to attract attention. And the thing we don't want to do in the worship service, whether it's dressing down or overdressing, is to attract attention to us, because the worship service is about giving attention to God, not us. And maybe if each of us would spend a little bit more time preparing our heart rather than our face, we might be in a little bit better position to worship. And I appreciate all the people that take time to look their best. I think that's appropriate. I don't mean that. But it seems to me like as we prepare for worship and as we come to the worship service, it's awfully easy for us to give attention to the things that attract attention to us, good or bad, rather than doing it in such a way to help our brothers and sisters around us focus on the Lord. I don't want to do anything during the worship service. I don't want to dress in any way during the worship service that makes it harder for anybody to focus on God. And if I do, and certainly if I did it when I shouldn't or without thinking, I think that's wrong. I think that is absolutely wrong. Comments or questions? That's probably a warm enough potato that only the bravest of heart will touch it. But I have had several of you ask me to make a few comments on that. I think in the same... I thought I saw... If a hand goes up, grab it, Marty. Don't let it go back down. I think in the same sense, we need to conduct ourselves in the worship service so that we are not distracting. And I suspect... that sometimes our bladders shrink as we enter the church door. And we find people going to the restroom much more frequently at church than they do at other points in their activity. David?
I know it's a hot topic, but I'm going to touch on it anyway. I find it, some forms of dress that I see in congregations, to me is just flat out disrespectful. We're there to serve God, show respect to God, and sometimes the way that we come into the church building, I think that, you know, if you come looking like a slob, it's just entirely disrespectful to God. And one thing that really bothers me, and I'll go ahead and approach it, is this whole idea of wearing shorts to the worship services. I think that in and of itself is very disrespectful, and I know there's a lot of people that do not agree, but I think that's really on the verge of being disrespectful.
If you're expecting me to say anything, you've got a long wait. Lowell?
Combine that, with, if you will, with, like, you know, we want you here. I guess the problem, the biggest problem I see with shorts is with the people that are sidetracked or visitors. Like we had the lady that was very quick to share all her opinions with us about her service the other night. That was one big objection she had. Now, I don't know how many people that keeps away or what, but we do want you here. Can we address that situation same time?
Well, you know what I want to say.
Give
that's
it to
a
your
good,
local elders.
Awesome, good topic for you to take up with your local eldership. But I will comment on. You know, I'm torn on this. I really am, because the scripture tells us we need to dress modestly, and some of this is cultural. Some of it is preference. I'm fully aware of that, and we need to look into each of our own hearts and check our attitude as to why we're doing it. I got pet peeves, you got pet peeves, but my pet peeves don't mean anything. It's only what God cares about that means anything. What'd you ask? Just real quickly, I lost my train of thought.
We want you here.
Yeah, we do want you here, but we need to also be considerate of one another so that we're not overly distracted. We can let ourselves be distracted by anything, and that's immature. And we can do things that distract other people, and that's inappropriate. But I think there is an element of reverence, or a reverential attitude that we need in our worship service. And I think that carries over into our conduct, how focused we are, our attire. Let me just repeat some comments that have been made to me. Let me do that. I hope I'm not dodging the bullet. You know, one person said to me this week, we wouldn't dress like that for our father's funeral. So why would we dress like that as we come to commemorate the Son of God's memorial? Well, there's some truth to that. But yet at the same time, I don't want to impose things that the Bible doesn't impose. And the Bible simply, basically about dress, says it needs to be modest. My point is, modesty is more than just overly revealing. Modesty is anything that attracts attention to us. And if we keep that in mind, and we conduct ourselves in our apparel and in our focus and in the worship service, I don't think we'll go too far wrong. And I can't judge what's in other people's heads and other people's minds, and I don't want to. People that were raised differently than I will have different preferences. That's because we are the product of our environment. Where are we at? Suzanne?
I was only at work for a couple of hours today, and I had the TV on. and Dr. Phil was on, and there was an argument between a husband and wife about the clothing that their daughters were wearing. And Dr. Phil said something that I think that we women sometimes don't understand, and especially young girls. And he just come right out and said, the testosterone levels in teenage boys is very extremely high. And the sight of a bare leg or a short dress, skirt, showing skin that shouldn't be shown can really be set a person's mind in the wrong place. And I think that that needs to be taken into consideration.
Well, I think any Christian woman or Christian girl would want to be considered in that regard. Did Bruce take the mic? Bruce?
Actually, I think this one we could keep going for
a
long time. But if I might, can I take a twist? We would talk about worship all week, and you know, the assembly type worship. And I've noticed in some congregations that they do. You know, we have a sing. We have a last Sunday, last Wednesday. That's how much I can remember. Last Wednesday on the week, we have of the month, we have a sing, which I think is good. I think we are modeling what I think God, you know, put in the scripture that we do. But I also think that there is a modeling of prayer service there also. I'm not so sure we shouldn't intermingle those, make it half and half, or have as much for prayer as we have for singing, for a variety of reasons. One, I'm not sure we share enough internally amongst individuals. We have families here that are close, but we have other, you know, sometimes we have families that are, dare I say it, maybe too closed or close, that we maybe need to share better between families.
Well, James says, confess your faults one to another, and that is a sharing element.
And when people from the audience would say, you know, I think we need to pray for such and such about such and such, that might be a way to be more inclusive and more understanding of what's going on in a bigger picture. And also, I think it would be able to have some of the younger see that modeling going on. And I will stop.
Okay. I appreciate that. I think there's some good thoughts there. I wasn't going to make this comment, but I'm going to. It's not about you or us. But a lot of us go to Eminence, and I was talking to someone this week, and I think that it is. I think a lot of awfully good things occur at Eminence, and it's been very beneficial for my sons. Donna and I enjoy it, and I'll continue to go. But there is a casualness there, sometimes to the point, in my opinion, of immodesty. I'm not talking casual, immodesty. That I find troubling, and I wonder if that hasn't caused some congregations to bring that, to embolden and bring that back a little bit in ways that aren't what we really want to do. So those of us going down there, maybe if we just do a little extra soul searching to make sure, even if it is hot and humid, that modesty is the clarion call, because that is always appropriate for a Christian. Always appropriate for a Christian. A few years ago, I seriously considered never going back, just for that reason. I decided that wasn't the right thing for me to do. But it is a concern that I have, and I've never shared that with a group publicly. But I just did. Take it for what it's worth. Throw it out if it's not appropriate. And I hope you all come to him. Yes,
I think that's kind of a problem that we have with society in general. I think we've dumbed down how we dress. And I know a lot of corporations have had to institute dress codes because people come to work dressed like they're going to clean their house. And they don't know how to dress anymore because...
That's somewhat true.
And
but some of those same corporations institute casual day once a week now.
Well, when I was at Mercy...
Which isn't wrong.
When I was at Mercy, they took casual day away because it just got to be so horrible that, people are coming just dressed so terrible that they took it away. But I think that has infiltrated every strata of society,
yeah.
And people don't understand how it appears.
I'm sure that's true. I don't know this for a fact because I'm not a woman, but I have been told by more than one Christian mother and girl that it is very, very difficult to go to a shopping mall and find what they would call modest dress. And if that's true, and I've not shopped for women's clothes, I haven't. I really haven't. I don't know why I'm smiling. That's very, very unfortunate, but you can find modest clothes even if you have to go online, I have been told. But I think you can probably find them somewhere. But it is unfortunate, and there's a lot of peer pressure. And we're not talking about the assembly per se, we're just talking about, one of the clarion calls of the religious world today is that we need to be relevant. And I agree, but I believe the Lord's church is relevant by being distinctive and following the New Testament examples. It is not relevant by trying to see how close it can get to every fad that comes along. Whether it be in the worship service, in our dress, in our conduct, or whatever. If we don't have, the Lord's gospel is distinctive, and if we take the distinctiveness out of it, then we're no longer presenting the gospel. Period. Thank you very much for your patience. It seems like we've discussed some of these things before, but they're always good to follow through. There's no virtue in being different, just to be different. The virtue is to be godly. But I think if we are godly, we will have a distinctiveness that will be noticed.